Chapter 2. Silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered. Please God, make him think I am still pretty. The door opened and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that as he had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. Jim, darling, she cried, don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again, you won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas. Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you. You've cut off your hair? Asked Jim, laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet even after the hardest mental labor. Cut it off and sold it, said Della. Aren't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I? Jim looked about the room curiously. You say your hair is gone? He said, with an air almost of idiocy. You needn't look for it, said Della. Tea's sold, I tell you, sold and gone too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered, she went on with sudden serious sweetness, but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim? Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. Don't make any mistake, Del, he said, about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut, or a shave or a shampoo, that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first. White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper. And then an ecstatic scream of joy. And then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoise shell, with jeweled rims just the shade, to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now, they were hers, but the tresses, that should have adorned the coveted adornments, were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "Why hair grows so fast, Jim?" And Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch, and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Del," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away, and keep 'em a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch, to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said, that of all who give gifts these two were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the magi. A cosmopolite in a cafe, at midnight the cafe was crowded. By some chance the little table at which I sat, had escaped the eye of incomers, and two vacant chairs at it extended their arms with venal hospitality to the influx of patrons. And then a cosmopolite sat in one of them, and I was glad, for I held a theory, that since Adam no true citizen of the world has existed. We hear of them, and we see foreign labels on much luggage, but we find travelers instead of cosmopolites. I invoke your consideration of the scene, the marble-topped tables, the range of leather-upholstered wall seats, the gay company, the ladies dressed in demi-state toilets, speaking in an exquisite visible chorus of taste, economy, opulence or art, the sedulous and largest loving tilde G-A-R-C-O-N-S tilde, the music wisely catering to all with its raids upon the composers. The tilde M-E-L-A-N-G-E tilde of talk and laughter, and, if you will, the Wurzburger in the tall glass cones, that bend to your lips as a ripe cherry sways on its branch to the beak of a robber jay. I was told by a sculptor from Mauchchunk that the scene was truly Parisian. My cosmopolite was named E. Rushmore Coughlin, and he will be heard from next summer at Coney Island. He is to establish a new attraction there, he informed me, offering kingly diversion. And then his conversation ran along parallels of latitude and longitude. He took the great, round world in his hand, so to speak, familiarly, contemptuously, and it seemed no larger than the seat of a maraschino cherry in a tilde table d'hote tilde grapefruit. He spoke disrespectfully of the equator, he skipped from continent to continent, he derided the zones, he mopped up the high seas with his napkin. With a wave of his hand he would speak of a certain bazaar in Hyderabad. Whiff! He would have you on skis in Lapland. Zip! Now you rode the breakers with the Kanakas at Kalaikahiki. Presto! He dragged you through an Arkansas post-oak swamp, let you dry for a moment on the alkali plains of his Idaho ranch, then whirled you into the society of Viennese archdukes. Anon he would be telling you of a cold he acquired in a Chicago lake breeze, and how old Escamilla cured it in Buenos Aires with a hot infusion of the tilde C-H-U-C-H-U-L-A tilde weed. You would have addressed a letter to Dr. Rushmore Coughlin Esquire, the Earth, Solar System, the Universe, and have mailed it, feeling confident that it would be delivered to him. I was sure that I had found at last the one true cosmopolite since Adam, and I listened to his worldwide discourse fearful lest I should discover in it the local note of the mere globe-trotter. But his opinions never fluttered or drooped. He was as impartial to cities, countries and continents as the winds or gravitation. And as E. Rushmore Coughlin prattled of this little planet I thought with glee of a great almost cosmopolite who wrote for the whole world, and dedicated himself to Bombay. In a poem he has to say, that there is pride, and rivalry between the cities of the earth, and that the men, that breed from them, they traffic up and down, but cling to their cities hem as a child to the mother's gown. And whenever they walk by roaring streets unknown they remember their native city as faithful, foolish, fond, making her mere brief name their bond upon their bond. And my glee was roused, because I had caught Mr. Kipling napping. Here I had found a man not made from dust, one who had no narrow boasts of birthplace or country, one who, if he bragged at all, would brag of his whole round globe against the Martians, and the inhabitants of the moon. Expression on these subjects was precipitated from E. Rushmore Coughlin by the third corner to our table. While Coughlin was describing to me the topography along the Siberian Railway, the orchestra glided into a medley. The concluding air was icy, and as the exhilarating notes tumbled forth, they were almost overpowered by a great clapping of hands from almost every table. It is worth a paragraph to say that this remarkable scene can be witnessed every evening in numerous cafes in the city of New York. Tons of brew have been consumed over theories to account for it. Some have conjectured hastily that all Southerners in town tie themselves to cafes at nightfall. This applause of the able air in a northern city does puzzle a little, but it is not insolvable. The war with Spain, many years generous mint and watermelon crops, a few long-shot winners at the New Orleans racetrack, and the brilliant banquets given by the Indiana and Kansas citizens who compose the North Carolina Society have made the South rather a fad in Manhattan. Your manicure will list softly that your left forefinger reminds her so much of a gentleman's in Richmond, Virginia. Oh, certainly. But many a lady has to work now the war, you know. When Icy was being played, a dark-haired young man sprang up from somewhere with a Mosby gorilla yell, and waved frantically his soft-brimmed hat. Then he strayed through the smoke, dropped into the vacant chair at our table, and pulled out cigarettes. The evening was at the period when reserve is thawed. One of us mentioned three Wurzburgers to the waiter. The dark-haired young man acknowledged his inclusion in the order by a smile and a nod. I hastened to ask him a question, because I wanted to try out a theory I had. "Would you mind telling me," I began, "whether you are from the Fist of E. Rushmore?" Coughlin banged the table, and I was jarred into silence. "Excuse me," said he, "but that's a question I never like to hear asked. What does it matter where a man is from? Is it fair to judge a man by his post office address? Why, I've seen Kentuckians who hated whiskey, Virginians who weren't descended from Pocahontas, Indianians who hadn't written a novel, Mexicans who didn't wear velvet trousers with silver dollars sewed along the seams, funny Englishmen, spendthrift Yankees, cold-blooded Southerners, narrow-minded Westerners, and New Yorkers who were too busy to stop for an hour on the street to watch a one-armed grocer's clerk do up cranberries in paper bags. Let a man be a man, and don't handicap him with the label of any section." "Pardon me," I said, but my curiosity was not altogether an idle one. "I know the South, and when the band plays Dixie I like to observe. I have formed the belief that the man who applauds that air with special violence and ostensible sectional loyalty is invariably a native of either Secaucus, N.J.J., or the district between Murray Hill Lyceum and the Harlem River, this city." I was about to put my opinion to the test by inquiring of this gentleman, when you interrupted with your own larger theory, I must confess. And now the dark-haired young man spoke to me, and it became evident that his mind also moved along its own set of grooves. "I should like to be a periwinkle," said he, mysteriously, "on the top of a valley, and sing tooraloo-ralloo." This was clearly too obscure, so I turned again to Coughlin. "I've been around the world 12 times, said he. "No an Esquima in a Bernovic who sends to Cincinnati for his neckties, and I saw a goat herder in Uruguay who won a prize in a Battle Creek breakfast food puzzle competition. I pay rent on a room in Cairo, Egypt, and another in Yokohama all the year round. I've got slippers waiting for me in a tea house in Shanghai, and I don't have to tell 'em how to cook my eggs in Rio de Janeiro or Seattle. It's a mighty little old world. What's the use of bragging about being from the North, or the South, or the old manor house in the Dale, or Euclid Avenue, Cleveland, or Pikes Peak, or Fairfax County, Virginia, or Hooligan's Flats or any place? It'll be a better world when we quit being fools about some mildewed town or 10 acres of swampland, just because we happen to be born there." "You seem to be a genuine cosmopolite," I said admiringly. "But it also seems that you would decry patriotism." "A relic of the Stone Age," declared Coughlin, warmly. "E are all brothers Chinamen, Englishmen, Zulus, Patagonians and the people in the bend of the Kaw River. Someday all this petty pride in one city or state or section or country will be wiped out, and we'll all be citizens of the world, as we ought to be. But while you are wandering in foreign lands, I persisted, do not your thoughts revert to some spot, some dear and nary a spot, interrupted E.R. Coughlin, flippantly. He terrestrial, globular, planetary hunk of matter, slightly flattened at the poles, and known as the Earth, is my abode. I've met a good many object-bound citizens of this country abroad. I've seen men from Chicago sit in a gondola in Venice on a moonlight night and brag about their drainage canal. I've seen a southerner on being introduced to the King of England and that monarch, without batting his eyes, the information that his grand-aunt on his mother's side was related by marriage to the Perkinses of Charleston. I knew a New Yorker who was kidnapped for ransom by some Afghanistan bandits. His people sent over the money and he came back to Kabul with the agent. Afghanistan? The native said to him through an interpreter. Well, not so slow, do you think? I don't know, says he, and he begins to tell him about a cab driver at 6th Avenue and Broadway. Those ideas don't suit me. I'm not tied down to anything that isn't 8,000 miles in diameter. Just put me down as E. Rushmore Coughlin, citizen of the terrestrial sphere. My cosmopolite made a large adieu and left me, for he thought he saw someone through the chatter and smoke whom he knew. So I was left with the would-be Periwinkle, who was reduced to Wurzburger without further ability to voice his aspirations to perch, melodious, upon the summit of a valley. I sat reflecting upon my evident cosmopolite and wondering how the poet had managed to miss him. He was my discovery, and I believed in him. How was it? He men that breathe from them, they traffic up and down, but cling to their city's hem as a child to the mother's gown. Not so E. Rushmore Coughlin. With the whole world for his, my meditations were interrupted by a tremendous noise and conflict in another part of the cafe. I saw above the heads of the seated patrons E. Rushmore Coughlin, and a stranger to me engaged in terrific battle. They fought between the tables like titans, and glasses crashed, and men caught their hats up, and were knocked down, and a brunette screamed, and a blonde began to sing easing. My cosmopolite was sustaining the pride and reputation of the earth, when the waiters closed in on both combatants with their famous flying wedge formation, and bore them outside, still resisting. I called McCarthy, one of the French tilde G-A-R-C-O-N-S tilde, and asked him the cause of the conflict. The man with the red tie, that was my cosmopolite, said he, got hot on account of things said about the bum sidewalks and water supply of the place he come from by the other guy. Why, said I, bewildered, that man is a citizen of the world, a cosmopolite. He, originally from Madawamkeag, Maine, he said, continued McCarthy, and he wouldn't stand for no knock in the place. Between rounds, the May moon shone bright upon the private boarding house of Mrs. Murphy. By reference to the almanac, a large amount of territory will be discovered upon which its rays also fell. Spring was in its heyday, with hay fever soon to follow. The parks were green with new leaves, and buyers for the western and southern trade. Flowers and summer resort agents were blowing, the air and answers to Lawson were growing milder, hand organs, fountains and pinochle were playing everywhere. The windows of Mrs. Murphy's boarding house were open. A group of boarders were seated on the high stoop upon round, flat mats like German pancakes. In one of the second floor front windows Mrs. McCaskey awaited her husband. Supper was cooling on the table. Its heat went into Mrs. McCaskey. At 9 Mr. McCaskey came. He carried his coat on his arm, and his pipe in his teeth, and he apologized for disturbing the boarders on the steps as he selected spots of stone between them on which to set his size 9, width DS. As he opened the door of his room he received a surprise. Instead of the usual stove-lid or potato masher for him to dodge, came only words. Mr. McCaskey reckoned that the benign May moon had softened the breast of his spouse. I heard he came the oral substitutes for kitchenware. Eakin apologized to riffraff of the streets for setting yer unhandy feet on the tails of their frocks, but he'd walk on the neck of yer wife the length of a clothesline without so much as a kiss me foot, apostrophe, and I'm sure it's that long from rubber and out the windy for ye, and the victuals cold such as there's money to buy, after drinking up yer wages at Galler's every Saturday evening, and the gas man here twice today for his woman. Said Mr. McCaskey, dashing his coat and hat upon a chair, the noise of he is an insult to me appetite. When he run down politeness he take the mortar from between the bricks of the foundations of society. Tis no more than exercise in the acrimony of a gentleman, when he ask the descent of ladies blocking the way for step in between them. Will he bring the pig's face of he out of the windy, and see to the food? Mrs. McCaskey arose heavily, and went to the stove. There was something in her manner that warned Mr. McCaskey. When the corners of her mouth went down suddenly like a barometer it usually foretold a fall of crockery and tinware. Pig's face, is it? Said Mrs. McCaskey, and hurled a stewpan full of bacon and turnips at her lord. Mr. McCaskey was no novice at repartee. He knew what should follow the entree. On the table was a roast sirloin of pork, garnished with shamrocks. He retorted with this, and drew the appropriate return of a bread pudding in an earthen dish. A hunk of Swiss cheese accurately thrown by her husband struck Mrs. McCaskey below one eye. When she replied with a well-aimed coffee pot full of a hot, black, semi-fragrant liquid, the battle, according to courses, should have ended. But Mr. McCaskey was no 50-cent tilde table d'hoter tilde. Let cheap bohemians consider coffee the end, if they would. Let them make that tilde faux pas tilde. He was foxier still. Finger bowls were not beyond the compass of his experience. They were not to be had in the pension Murphy, but their equivalent was at hand. Triumphantly he sent the graniteware wash basin at the head of his matrimonial adversary. Mrs. McCaskey dodged in time. She reached for a flat iron, with which, as a sort of cordial, she hoped to bring the gastronomical duel to a close. But a loud, wailing scream downstairs caused both her and Mr. McCaskey to pause in a sort of involuntary armistice. On the sidewalk at the corner of the house policeman Cleary was standing with one ear upturned, listening to the crash of household utensils. "'Tis John McCaskey and his missus at it again," meditated the policeman. "'Wonder shall I go up and stop the row? I will not. Married folks they are, and few pleasures they have. 'Twill not last long. Sure, they'll have to borrow more dishes to keep it up with." And just then came the loud scream below stairs, Bedekin in fear of dire extremity. "'Tis probably the cat," said policeman Cleary, and walked hastily in the other direction. The boarders on the steps were fluttered. Mr. Toomey, an insurance solicitor by birth and an investigator by profession, went inside to analyze the scream. He returned with the news that Mrs. Murphy's little boy, Mike, was lost. Following the messenger, out bounced Mrs. Murphy £200 in tears and hysterics, clutching the air and howling to the sky for the loss of £30 of freckles and mischief. Bathus, truly, but Mr. Toomey sat down at the side of Miss Purdy, millinery, and their hands came together in sympathy. The two old maids, Mrs. Walsh, who complained every day about the noise in the halls, inquired immediately if anybody had looked behind the clock. Major Grigg, who sat by his fat wife on the top step, arose and buttoned his coat. "He little one lost?" he exclaimed. "We'll scour the city. His wife never allowed him out after dark. But now," she said. "Oh, Ludovic!" in a baritone voice. Heaver can look upon that mother's grief without springing to her relief, as a heart of stone. "I've me some 30 or 60 cents, my love," said the major. "Us children sometimes stray far. I may need car fares. Old man Denny, hall room, fourth floor back, who sat on the lowest step, trying to read a paper by the street lamp, turned over a page to follow up the article about the carpenter's strike. Mrs. Murphy shrieked to the moon. H. R. R. Mike, F. apostrophe R. God's sake, where is me little bit of a boy? When did he see him last? Asked old man Denny, with one eye on the report of the Building Trades League. Oh, wailed Mrs. Murphy, 'twas yesterday, or maybe 4 hours ago. I dunno. But it's lost he is, me little boy Mike. He was playing on the sidewalk only this morning, or was it Wednesday? I'm that busy with work, 'tis hard to keep up with dates. But I've looked the house over from top to cellar, and it's gone he is. Oh, for the love of Ivan, silent, grim, colossal, the big city has ever stood against its revilers. They call it hard as iron. They say that no pulse of pity beats in its bosom. They compare its streets with lonely forests and deserts of lava. But beneath the hard crust of the lobster is found a delectable and luscious food. Perhaps a different simile would have been wiser. Still, nobody should take offense. We would call no one a lobster without good and sufficient claws. No calamity so touches the common heart of humanity as does the straying of a little child. Their feet are so uncertain and feeble, the ways are so steep and strange. Major Griggs hurried down to the corner, and up the avenue into Billy's place. M-A-R-I-I, he said to the servitor. Haven't seen a bow-legged, dirty-faced little devil of a six-year-old loot kid around here anywhere, have you? Mr. Toomey retained Miss Purdy's hand on the steps. Think of that dear little babe, said Miss Purdy, lost from his mother's side perhaps already fallen beneath the iron hoofs of galloping steeds. Oh, isn't it dreadful? Ain't that right? Agreed Mr. Toomey, squeezing her hand. I start out and help look for Perhaps, said Miss Purdy, you should. But, oh, Mr. Toomey, you are so dashing, so reckless. Suppose in your enthusiasm some accident should befall you, then what? Old man Denny read on about the arbitration agreement, with one finger on the lines. In the second floor front, Mr. and Mrs. McCaskey came to the window to recover their second wind. Mr. McCaskey was scooping turnips out of his vest with a crooked forefinger, and his lady was wiping an eye that the salt of the roast pork had not benefited. They heard the outcry below, and thrust their heads out of the window. "'Tis little Mike is lost," said Mrs. McCaskey, in a hushed voice, the beautiful, little, trouble-making angel of a gossoon. "'The bit of a boy mislaid?" said Mr. McCaskey, leaning out of the window. Hi, now, that's bad enough, entirely. The childer, they be different. If 'twas a woman I'd be willin', for they leave peace behind them when they go. Disregarding the thrust, Mrs. McCaskey caught her husband's arm. John, she said, sentimentally, Mrs. Murphy's little boy is lost. 'Tis a great city for losing little boys. 6 years old he was. John. 'Tis the same age our little boy would have been if we had had one 6 years ago. We never did, said Mr. McCaskey, lingering with the fact. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.